This week on the Wildcard Hour, we have a special interview with Felix Belmont, one of the founders of KVNF and a former longtime DJ. This interview comes to us from independent producer Alan Wardes, whose podcast, The Flyovers, tells the stories of out-of-the-way places and people who are off the beaten path.
I'm Alan Wardes. Welcome to a special edition of The Flyovers.
The Flyovers is a traveling podcast of people and place in small-town America, because everywhere and everyone has a story to tell.
My guest today is Felix Belmont. Upon his retirement from appearing on the air at age 101 last November, Felix was one of the oldest, if not the oldest, working public radio DJs in America. His big band music show, Stop Time, entertained listeners for decades at KVNF-FM in Paonia, Colorado. After a long and successful career in international sales, Felix retired to Paonia in the 70s and quickly developed a passion for public radio. He was instrumental in helping KVNF founder Campbell Stanton realize his dream of bringing community radio to the North Fork Valley of Colorado and beyond. In this episode of The Flyovers, Felix tells his story, including the years he spent in World War II standing toe-to-toe with the Japanese Army in the Aleutian Islands of Alaska. Well, let's begin as you suggested. Tell us your name.
My full name is Felix Ireland Belmont. Ireland is my middle name, and that was my mother's maiden name. Belmont was my father's name. Mm.
And you're a resident of Paonia.
I'm a resident of Paonia.
And have been for a long time.
I have been a resident of the North Fork Valley since July of 1978, I believe it was.
July of 1978.
Yeah.
Well, Felix, you're 101 years old now.
Yes, I'm 101.
How old were you when you moved here?
78, and I was born in 18. Mm-hmm. So that's 60 years old.
Yeah. So yeah. What brought you here?
Okay. My daughter was up in New England and met a lady by the name of Olheiser. This lady had been out here previously, and she and my daughter became friends. And she said, you really ought to see this Western Colorado. It's so interesting. And my daughter at that time had a Volkswagen bus, you know, these buses. Mm-hmm. So anyway, to make a long story short, they decided to quit what they were doing and drive out here. Mm. But she kept saying to me, Dad, you ought to buy some land out here. It's so great.
Had you visited at all at this point?
Not quite at this point. This is, I'll explain that. Mm-hmm. And I'm working for the Borden Company in New York. And then one day she called me, Dad, I found a place for you. It turned out that Steve Wolcott, who lives up on Stucker Mesa, had bought something like 200 acres or so. And he had a balloon payment coming up, and he didn't have the money to meet that. And the amount that he owed on this balloon payment at the going rate for land at that time around here equated to about 65 acres. So my wife and I decided to come out and visit my daughter and take a look at the land. And I was thinking about retirement then, because I was then 57 or 58 years mm-hmm. old, and I was thinking about retirement. We looked at the land, we decided we'd buy 65 acres, and we went back and forth, mm-hmm. as people do in New York. People around here don't do it. They were a little put off that I, never accept the quoted price. You hodl.
You taught them a thing or two then.
Yeah. Anyway, to make a long story short, we bought 65 acres. So Steve, who sold it to me, said, right after I bought it, well, what are you going to do with it? And I said, I don't know. And he said, well, why don't I lease the land, since the land he sold me adjoined his own land? And he said, lease it back and I'll continue growing hay and we'll go on like that. So he leased it from me, but at no cash exchange of money, but he was to take care, he took care of it and help build some fences where they were needed and mm-hmm. so on. So I'm coming up on 60 years of age and I'm a general manager in Borden Chemical Company, and my job was in their international division, in their export, and I was selling export chemicals abroad. As a matter of fact, I have never sold a dollar's worth of goods in the United States. My whole business career has been export sales. Mm-hmm. So we owned this 60 acres, and I decided to develop it. There was not even a driveway from the highway into my land. And down in the little gulch, in Runzel Gulch, next to it, there obviously was water if it was developed, so I developed a spring and so on to have water for the house site, which I was planning. And I was introduced to a builder here, and we decided to build a house here. And we're building it by mail and telephone calls with this builder, but he was well recommended, and so it worked out okay. Well, I'm working in Borden at 35th and Madison Avenue, right in Manhattan, commuting from Long Island like several million other people every day. And so uh-huh. General manager, I had this department, a little department. So, and I had guys dying on each side of me just from the stress of working. And every year you had to come up with a bigger budget and the whole thing. Uh-huh. And I got to thinking, I'm going to beat these odds. It so happened that my wife, Pauline, was 3 years older than I was. What that meant was that she would be eligible to draw Social Security a couple of years ahead of me, so we would have that additional income. So I said, are you willing to... And I was really concerned about her, because she had a very good job in New York with paying well and so on. Are you willing to quit and we pull up stakes and
move to the mountains?
Move to the mountains and so on. She said, if that's what you want to do, sure. So to make a long story short, we quit our job and we moved out here. And by that time, the house that we had been building was just completed, so we had a house to move into. Anyway, we moved out here, and just at that time, Campbell Stanton was establishing KVNF. Mm-hmm.
The public radio station.
The public radio station here. And I decided to volunteer.
Why? What was it about radio that attracted you?
way back when we lived in Los Angeles, my sixth grade teacher, her husband was the manager of KMPC in Beverly Hills, which was located, the whole station, including the tower, in their gas station, which was right at the western end of Beverly Hills, right on Wilshire Boulevard. Anyway, in sixth grade, we were studying King Arthur, the Arthur legends, and so on. And my sixth grade teacher, well, her husband was general manager at KMPC, and they had a children's program like radio stations do. And she suggested to her husband that we go down and do this Arthur legend. And I was Sir Gareth, and there was some of the other kids in the class. And so they didn't trust us with memory. They prepared our script on big boards so that we could have it to read, you know. Anyway, yeah. We did the program. That was my first exposure to radio. But somehow it kind of...
It got into your blood.
It got into my blood. But after that, I had no exposure to radio for years later. I did no radio in college or anything like that.
But in those days, radio drama was really a big thing.
Radio drama was a big thing. Anyway, that was my first exposure to radio.
And you walked away and never got involved again until KBNF?
Yeah.
Really?
But somehow it interested me. Mm-hmm. And we'd retired here and I had nothing to do and so on. And Campbell Stanton was just starting KBNF. And the station was up on Garvin Mesa here where he lives. And he remodeled an old building there, sort of a barn, and the station and everything was in that. And I signed up and became a DJ. And he had a partner here. He suggested that since I was a DJ, that I start a program of show tunes, of 30s and 40s music, big band music.
Yeah.
Which is just my thing. I mean, time-wise, you know, sort of thing.
Sure, and, but were you a fan also of that kind of music?
Sort of,
yeah.
Sort of. My one connection, direct connection with the big band thing was that Glenn Miller and his orchestra played for my senior college prom live.
Where was that?
In Baltimore in 1940, the spring of 40. I went to Johns Hopkins in Baltimore. So where was I? So I'm here in Paonia. I started a radio program which was named Stop Time by the then manager of the station. Well, I'm still doing the bloody program twice a month.
So that's 40 years later, still doing that program.
Yeah, I do it twice a month.
Well, so in 40 years, you're still doing radio.
Let me add that I got involved with radio, with KVNF. They had a vacancy on the board, and I joined the board. And I became vice president of the board. And then I served three terms as president of the board. And then nobody wanted to be treasurer, and I took over as treasurer. And I ended up serving on the KVNF board for over 20 years.
The first 20 years of its existence?
Essentially.
Because there's a plaque down at KVNF.
There's a plaque.
Yeah,
but
it really suggests that you were instrumental in getting that station fully into existence.
I joined KVNF when I was 60 years old. And all the people in KVNF, almost all the people, were, I hate to use the word kids, but relative. They were young.
Yeah.
But I saw a certain little niche for me in that. I could approach people of my age in the community when we had fund drive and say, hey, John, get your bloody checkbook out. I want $100 from you. The kids couldn't go to older people like that.
Right.
So I made that my little position on the board to liaise, is that the word?
Yeah, yeah.
With people of my generation and to get them interested. In, because when KVNF was first started, everybody around town was saying, oh, that bunch of hippies down the street and so on.
Well, that's the reputation that public radio had in those days, I
think. Yeah, radio had a bunch of hippies, you know.
Yeah.
And we were, for a while, up on Garvin Mesa. Then we moved down to the little store that's next to the theater. And we eventually bought that. And then we bought the present building because we were expanding, we were growing. Mm-hmm. That was a major purchase. And it involved taking on a big mortgage and so on. Mm-hmm. Well, they ran a fund drive, a special fund drive, to raise the down payment even for that. And I forget how much we paid for it. It was over $100,000. And I went around mainly to these friends of mine. In other words, people my age, you know.
Yeah.
And I raised about, I think I raised $52,000 myself, a good hunk of it.
Yeah.
And that's why the manager then put my name up on the building. It's the Belmont Building.
Mm-hmm. Well, but don't be too dismissive of that, because public radio lives and dies.
Well, you know.
That
you know,
exact
it lives and dies.
Way.
Yes, I have been a factor.
Mm-hmm. Well, and you were able to say, it's not just a hippie station. Look, we've got stop time.
And when it came time that we needed money, I said, we've got to go to the bank. And the then founder, he and I were both World War II veterans, and we both had served in the Pacific. And I could talk to him as, you know what I mean? The kids couldn't go up and see him.
No, not the same way.
In fact, in the beginning, he was very, almost contemptuous of KVNF, that bunch of hippies and so on. But I remember saying to him, I said, hey buddy, don't call me a hippie. I was in World War II just like you are, and I'm no hippie. I could talk to him like that. Right. But I hit him up for money for KVNF.
Well, help me out here. What would you say to somebody like that to sell him on the value of a public radio station to a community like this?
Well, I had to try to convince him of what public radio. He didn't even know what public radio was. So I gave him the basic spiel, you know, and so on.
Yeah, well, what is that, though? A lot of people still don't know exactly how valuable a public radio station is.
I'm not sure I still know, but you know what I mean.
Yeah.
And the funny thing was, his son had joined KVNF as a DJ. And I took his son with me when I went to see him for the first time, thinking that this would help because his son was a kid. But I forgot one thing. I worked for my father in New York, who had an import-export company for a number of years before I joined the Borden Company. And I was my father's son. There was no one lower or of less importance in the company than me. And I'm thinking that the founder of Pawnee State Bank, because his son was there, would help, was the biggest mistake I ever made, because this was like...
Yeah, to him, his son was perhaps the worst of the hippies.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. And I took him along thinking he could help, you know, and he just sat there and thought... Anyway, we got the loan, but I had to countersign it as an individual. When my wife found out about it...
She was starting to wish
you
stayed in New York.
In fact, I had some Borden stock, and I put that up as collateral for KVNF. And my wife, of course, eventually found out about it, you know, where I admitted to her, and she had a fit about it.
Okay, so why did you do that? Why did you feel strongly enough about the survival of this station?
I believed in KVNF and the public radio and the whole thing for the community.
Yeah.
And I thought, this is one thing I can do. And sure, I'm taking a risk, but I thought, it's worth it. And it was my thing. I had retired, and I had nothing to do. And I thought, there's nothing worse than being retired and having nothing to do. I simply changed jobs. I retired from Borden, and I got this job with KVNF. And I was interested, and I wanted KVNF to grow.
Yeah.
And to grow, we had to have more. We had to have money.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So I got our first loan, and after that, we got a line of credit with the bank and borrowed money every year, and we never were late on a repayment. I'm not bragging, but I think I was instrumental in doing that. But I never lost a penny. I mean,
yeah, that was my next question, was did it ever cost you any of your stock?
As far as I was concerned, it was worth it. I was willing to take that risk.
Sure. So if you were going to talk to somebody in another community thinking about starting a public radio station, what would you tell them? After all these years and all your involvement, what would you say to them about the value to their community of having something like this?
Try to get as many young people in it as you can, but also sell it to some older people, particularly some people that have got a checkbook, that have a little money, disposable money.
Mm-hmm.
Because you're not going to get the money from the kids. They don't have money. You've got to have a few people that... and we have had a few people.
Yeah.
Including Joe Cocker here. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we got him. This is later on.
Right. Well, and so let's let our listeners know, Joe Cocker had an establishment in a tiny little town called Crawford over the mountains there.
Yeah. But we hit him up through a mutual friend who knew him well, who had known him from when they were down in Jamaica, you know, and mm-hmm. so on. We hit him up for a very sizable donation, which he gave us.
Mm-hmm. Well, how does public radio, in your opinion, make a little town like this stronger and better? In what way does it really add to the vibrancy of community life?
It's non-commercial. It involves local people. They're not trying to sell Chevrolet cars. They're they have a different type of program schedule from commercial radio stations. They embrace what public radio is as compared with commercial radio.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. It's hard to explain.
Yeah.
But you gotta like it. You gotta kind of get it in your blood and so on.
Well, it's homegrown, as you've already
said.
Homegrown.
Look at the thing we're doing now. We have this raffle, and we're giving away a beautiful big Toyota truck.
That someone has donated?
We had to buy that truck.
Oh, I see.
But Hellman Motors in Delta, Mr. Hellman has been very cooperative, and he didn't give us that truck.
Uh-huh.
But we got a very... He gave it to us at cost, let's put it that way.
I see.
But we've sold, how many tickets? 70,000 or something. We've sold a whole bunch of tickets, you know.
Wow.
I forget exactly how many.
I'm Alan Wardis, and you're listening to The Flyovers. My guest today is Felix Belmont, World War II veteran and tireless champion of community radio in Western Colorado.
Well, I'd like to shift gears just a bit. Yep. And talk about how this little town of Paonia, Colorado has changed in the 40 years that you've been here.
You know, some people say it's changed so much. To me, it has not changed, interestingly enough.
Well, and it is interesting that you say that, because coal mining was such a big part. And
coal
mining,
it's changed in that respect. The coal thing has changed. It was everything. All the cash money in town in the old days was the weekly cash pay that the coal miners got.
Yeah.
So that is, of course, has all changed. And we got a surprising number of people, mostly from California, from the West Coast, coming in to live here. And these were very interesting people, because we had countless people with master's degrees, and we had a bunch of PhDs around town too.
Mm-hmm.
But this to me was never a country hick town. It was, in many ways, rather sophisticated, because you had people. You had the Ed Marsons, the Joe Cockers, the
many of them who came here for the same reason you did, to beat the odds.
Yeah.
Get probably out of the rat yeah. race, so to speak.
Yeah.
Not many jobs for PhDs around, though.
No. And even less now with the coal business is not what it was,
yeah.
of course.
Well, so back to your claim, though, that the community, in your opinion, really hasn't changed very much. Why do you say
it doesn't
that?
Seem to me that it's changed.
Mm-hmm.
But other people, you say, oh, geez, it's changed and so on. I don't see that it has changed. But it's not backward or anything. I mean, we have high-speed internet now. And, of course, you have to remember, too, that a lot of what I've been talking about was before computers. You know.
Oh, yeah.
You know.
Yeah, you were still spinning records in 1978.
Oh, yeah.
70.
I remember the first CD we had in KVNF, because somebody donated to us a little CD player for some reason. They didn't want it.
Mm.
And we didn't have a single CD in the house. And I went over to we had a sort of a record store or something across the street, and borrowed one CD so we could play the thing and so on. Everything was records for many years.
Uh-huh. What do you think about CDs versus records? There are a lot of people who swear by their records. They don't want anything.
They still
but
do, and we still have a big record library, and we still play a lot of records. But uh-huh. they're much easier to handle, you know.
Yeah.
And so on. But sure, we have two active turntables in the on-air room, and a lot of people still. In fact, I do too. I even do occasionally.
Mm-hmm.
I will play a record. So, I had a big record collection. Incidentally, what I didn't mention to you was that on July 4th, 1994, we had the Wake Fire here, and it came over from the West, and I lost my first house and everything in it, 100%.
How do you replace everything in a house?
Fortunately, I had very good insurance.
Uh-huh.
And we were able to, well, you didn't replace it, you just bought new stuff.
Yeah.
Fortunately, a lot of old photos and everything I had packed up in some boxes, because at that time I had three vehicles, two cars and a pickup truck, and we had a few minutes to grab stuff and throw it in the car and the truck. And
wow.
We saved a few things, you know.
Well, people all over the West live in fear of that very thing.
Yeah, well, it happened. And mm-hmm. My house was burned 100%.
Mm-hmm.
But we recovered from that. And
Well, so how do you think radio has changed in 40 years? We've talked about going from analog to digital. We went from records to CDs. And now we're going from CDs to online libraries. Do you think that the technology has changed how radio works?
Well, the technology's changed because we get so much of it off the satellite.
Mm-hmm. Has that changed how radio functions in a community like this? Is there any effect that you can see from technology that you would say, I really miss the old days?
Not really.
Yeah.
I don't think so. Mm-hmm. We're not fooling around with 78 LPs.
Right.
The techniques have changed. Like, a lot of people who are DJs now record their program on their computer. A lot of them on their, what do you call these?
iPads. Or
iPads, mm-hmm. and bring it in, and we have a connection there, and you just plug that in. And they do the whole program off that.
Well, so here's a good example of why I asked this question. You know, in the old days, if you were going to do a radio show, it was live or nothing. And now, if you can pre-record it, it takes away that immediacy
it
of
does.
A live
it
broadcast.
Does. It does. It takes away that. And they a lot of our DJs have it on their computer or their smartphone, whatever you want to call it. And they just play it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it does.
I think I miss that. Sometimes now I listen to radio and it does feel just a little bit too canned.
Exactly.
But here's another question. Is it getting harder for radio stations to survive in the day and age when it's all there on my phone? I can just subscribe to whatever internet application I want and I can get all
I think it's harder for them to survive because I question whether as many people listen to it.
Maybe for this reason, that there's
well,
so many
have
other
to
options.
You have the internet, you have...
But the one thing you're never going to get on the internet is a service like a lot of public radio stations provide.
Yeah,
or the...
we're very personal that way, you know. We have this bulletin board. You've heard. And some days, the whole bulletin board is composed of lost dogs, lost cats, or found dogs, found, mm-hmm. you know, kind of thing. Or people need a ride to Denver tomorrow, you know, that sort of thing.
Yeah. Well, as you look forward, you've been at this a long time. You can probably predict some trends. Do you see anything coming down the pike that you think is either positive or negative for radio and how it works?
I just hope that as we go from generation to generation, we can maintain their interest mm-hmm. enough to listen to the radio, to get them to listen to the radio.
Yeah.
Because they can listen on the internet, they can get it off the satellite. And of course... We have the whole thing, don't forget, we have the whole thing of TV, too. We haven't even mentioned that.
No. And even television is sort of an out-of-date term. We don't even know what that means anymore. It used to be three broadcast stations, and now it's hundreds of them.
My whole television gets fed by, when I moved in here, I had to have put a dish on the roof for me.
Uh-huh.
And it comes in through that cable, and that's what I watch, you know.
Yeah. Sometimes there are too many choices on TV, if you ask me. I don't know which to choose.
The bulk of what I listen to or watch on TV is Rocky Mountain PBS, you know, PBS.
Uh-huh.
So, and of course, I have my thing there where I can play a DVD.
Uh-huh.
I buy some DVDs of movies, play movies. But you, for radio, I think to survive, you have to have local people who are talking to other people, not over the radio, person to person, or in some way to, to make sure they're listening, you know.
Mm-hmm. So,
now, in a small town, you know everybody. I'm surprised at the number of people I meet on the street. Oh, I heard your program on Sunday. I kind of liked it, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't know, maybe it will die out. I don't know.
Yeah, well, people have made that prediction for a long time, and yet here we are. I remember when I went to university the first time, right out of high school, one of the first classes I took predicted the end of the newspaper within 10 years. We would no longer have physical newspapers.
Well, there have been a lot of newspapers go out of business.
True.
It's
but
true.
I think they were talking more that we would all just make this gigantic digital leap and leave them behind. And that hasn't happened.
But my one principle remaining New York provincialism is that I subscribe to, and every Sunday I get the Sunday New York Times religiously. And that's what this pile here is. I don't get it all read, I admit, but I get the Sunday New. There's no newspaper in the world that's to equal the New York Times, in my opinion.
And that's a great.
And I don't get it for the news. I get it for the feature, for the book reviews and mm-hmm. stuff, the travel section and the entertainment section and so on.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's a great example. New York Times traveling all the way to Paonia, Colorado, because you won't let it go. I'd like to think that there are a lot of people who will not let public radio go under any circumstances.
Yes. Yeah. Oh, I think there are.
Well, Felix, what a fascinating story, from playing King Arthur's Knights of the Round Table to being one of the, perhaps the pivotal founder of KVNF in Paonia, Colorado.
Well, I'm just one of many, but it was coincidence that my coming here coincided with Campbell just getting mm-hmm. KVNF started. Mm-hmm. And I saw a little something for me to do and joined. I was one of the very first people to join.
Well, a little something to do turned into quite a lot.
Yeah. And I found a home in KVNF. And quite frankly, if I hadn't done that, I would have had to find something else. Uh-huh. Otherwise, I'd be dead. I think retirement is a big mistake. You shouldn't retire. You leave what you're doing, and you plan to do something else that you're capable of. Whether it's intellectual, obviously you get older, you can't do the physical things you did before. Maybe. Mm-hmm. So, but you should certainly plan for some kind of activity and retirement. And fortunately, my wife got interested, and she became a DJ at KVNF and did the Sunday evening classical for 10 years. She's been dead 16 years now. Mm-hmm. There is a girl, Kim, I don't know her last name, she's in KVNF, has decided to write a history of KVNF, and I dug up some stuff I had in the files, and it'd be interesting to see what she comes up with.
Yeah.
There is not a whole lot in the KVNF files. The KVNF kind of just lived from day to day, as it progressed, you know. Mm-hmm. And with volunteers, there's been a tremendous turnover, you know. And,
yeah, there always is.
And it's surprising the number of people that were in KVNF who have passed on. I mean, mm-hmm. my wife is one of them. Mm-hmm. Joe Cocker's one of them.
Right.
And there are many others that are not maybe quite as well known, but we've had a number of DJs.
Well, 40 years is a long time.
Yeah. And well, I was 60 years old when I joined, for God's sake.
Yeah. I'm Alan Wardis, and you're listening to The Flyovers, a traveling podcast of people and place. My guest today is Paonia, Colorado centenarian Felix Belmont. When I first sat down to talk with Felix, my intention was to hear the story of his love for public radio and his role in helping KVNF get off the ground and grow over the past few decades in Paonia. I shouldn't have been surprised when he also shared a much earlier chapter in the tale of his life, the years he spent in the U.S. Army during World War II. Of course, it's an honor to hear such stories these days, when there are so few people left who can tell them firsthand. But beyond that, I was fascinated to learn that Felix served in a Pacific battleground that most people barely know existed, the Aleutian Islands of Alaska. In the remainder of the interview, Felix talks about a little-known Japanese incursion into U.S. territory during the war, and the role he played in helping to draw the line and hold it.
This thing about age, there were, I believe, the figure in round figures, there were 16 million who were in the military in World War II. There's something on the order of 450,000 still alive. They die, according to what you read, at the rate of about 500 a day. There's less than 500,000 World War II veterans still alive, from what I've heard. But after all, we're celebrating 75 years of the end of World War II. And, you know, the interesting thing about... See, I went to Johns Hopkins University, and I took 4 years of ROTC. So when I graduated in 1940, I also got a commission as a second lieutenant in the Army Infantry Reserve. So I graduated in 40, and we got into the war a couple of years later, and I got called up, and I was in the Army for 4 years. But I was, by that time, only 23 or 24 years old. And I was considered one of the old guys because the bulk of them were draftees who were 18 years of age, but a lot of them volunteered and lied about their ages, and there were 17 and even 16-year-old, the bulk of them. And I went in, and I was either 23 or 24, and I was considered one of the old guys, you know.
Yeah. What did you do throughout the war?
What did I do? My overseas service was up in the Aleutian Islands. And this was very interesting. All people really know about, well, to begin with, the Aleutian Islands were part of Alaska, U.S. territory. And sometime after Pearl Harbor, the Japanese sent another force up to the Aleutians with the idea of invading Dutch Harbor, which is about halfway out the chain. We were able to repulse them, so they couldn't land at Dutch Harbor. They turned around and they went out to Attu, which is the last island in the Aleutian chain, and they established a major base there. Well, this was of great embarrassment to the administration because this was the first time in history that a foreign power had occupied American territory, with the exception of Wake Island and a couple of them down there, but in the Western Hemisphere. And we had to drive them out. Well, when this first happened, we only had a couple of bases in the Aleutian chain. We established a number of major bases, Amchitka, Adak, Dutch Harbor was... Well, Dutch Harbor was a civilian town way before the war. So in the spring of 43, they organized a major force to invade Attu, and it was a joint venture with Canada, and it was a major operation. Just at the beginning of that operation, they formed a separate force of infantry and a engineer regiment and all the ancillaries, medical and quartermaster and everything, and sent them over to Shemya. Now, Shemya is a little island, a mile and a half wide and 5 miles long, that's just 40 miles this side of Attu. And the purpose of Shemya was, we bulldozed off the top of the island and built what was then said to be the longest single airstrip in the world. And this was to be a B-29 base for the northern push into Japan when we were going to make this major thing. Well, as soon as that was operational, even before the B-29 didn't even get there, but there were plenty of 25s, 24s, and 17s, and they're bombing northern Japan every day. What did I do? I was in my little outfit, the 37th Infantry Regiment, was in this group that was sent over to Shemya. So the first few days we were there, every different outfit on the island was sending their trucks down to the beach to pick up stuff that came off the boat, you know, and it was total confusion. This only went on for about 2 weeks. And suddenly the commanding general, we had a lieutenant, a brigadier general in command of the island, put out an order. He pulled all of the transportation, jeeps, trucks, and everything, from everybody on the island. He left each outfit with one truck, enough to go down to get rations for their outfit. And he formed a provisional truck company, put all of the transportation, mainly the trucks, in this provisional truck company. And he called a meeting, and he had all the outfits on the island send their junior officers down to one major, great big tent, all it was. And this, his deputy, Colonel Wheaton, started interviewing. How long you been in the Army, and so on and so on. Anyway, the upshot of it was they chose a first lieutenant who was in my outfit, and me as the two officers to command this provisional truck company. And we had more vehicles than a regiment. I forget how many. I had something like 200 trucks and so on. And our sole mission, and we worked on 3 8-hour shifts round the clock because they're building the airstrip. Mm-hmm. My mission was, and my commanding officer, who was the first lieutenant, not the second lieutenant. Yeah. And I like night work, so I took the night shifts, was to have our trucks go down to the beach, pick up everything came off the ships, and mainly the big cargo was the steel matting that was being used to build the airstrip and haul it up there to build the airstrip. So for several months until the thing was done, I'm working every night on the night shift hauling the steel. And I call them my trucks. Well, I was in command of them.
Well, yeah, they were.
to build the airstrip. Uh-huh. And that's what I did on Shemya. And we built it. And as soon as it turned out to be what they said was the longest single airstrip in the world. Later on, they paved it over and everything. But for most of its operation in the early days, it was the steel matting. So, well, I hauled all that stuff up there from off the ships. So that was my little contribution. And after the war is over, we're still in the prop days, the commercial planes that flew from the West Coast to Japan stopped there in Shemya to refuel. When the jets came in, they had enough range, they didn't have to stop there. But to this day, Shemya remains an emergency field, and there are a few people there, in case any plane that gets in trouble has a place to land. Mm-hmm. But in the prop days, they routinely stopped going over and coming back to refuel.
On the airstrip that you helped build.
Yeah.
Well, and there's a part of that story that you've left out, though, because I want to know what the Japanese made of all of this just 40 miles west in their grand base.
We were terribly afraid we were going to get bombed and everything. Uh-huh. They sent a few planes over, but they never actually bombed us, and if they sent a plane over, we sent our planes up and chased them away, or maybe shot a couple of them down. So, but we were very afraid of that. Mm-hmm. And all the buildings that we built on the island were underground. So the roof was about level with the ground. Mm-hmm. We had to dig out because we were afraid of getting bombed, and if so, they could have been destroyed and so on. But it became it's only a mile and a half wide and 5 miles long. It's a tiny little thing. It was larger, of course, but the equivalent of an aircraft carrier, you know, sitting out there in the ocean. Mm-hmm. And, as I say, it's still there to this day. Mm-hmm. Fortunately, the outfit that I was in, the 37th Infantry, had been up in the Aleutians for some time, and when they finally started to rotate units back and replace them with others, I inherited their seniority, their longevity at overseas, and I got back. I was only overseas 13 months. Some guys were over there 1 year, 2 years, 3 years, you know. Mm-hmm. I served at various posts, various bases around continental United States. Mm-hmm. But my overseas service was only 13 months, which was because you had to be at least 12. If you were less than 12, you got transferred out and assigned to another outfit there and had to stay there. Mm-hmm. But I just made it because I'd been 13 months, and I was very lucky in that respect. Mm-hmm. And because this was U.S. territory, and the Japanese were on Attu until we drove them out, and it was a major battle, but it was nothing, it was small, but compared to what was going on in the South Pacific, mm-hmm. and so on.
Right.
The censorship in the Aleutians was so severe, so exacting, that a lot of people in the army elsewhere didn't even know about it at the time. And to this day, you see all these accounts of war in the Pacific, and they're all about down the South, and you never hear Attu mentioned even. Mm-hmm. It's still almost a big secret to almost, even veterans don't know about it.
Yeah.
But we attacked them, we drove them out, we, quote, won. They said it was going to take 3 days and we were going to kick them out. The battle took 3 weeks to win, mm-hmm. and it was tough. And we had the help of some Canadians, and they brought the 7th Infantry Division, which was training in Southern California, to go over to South Africa. They brought them up for the Battle of Attu, and they landed with desert boots on and so on.
Yeah.
And the major casualties in the Battle of Attu with trench foot and stuff like, we had guys crawling back from the front lines because they couldn't walk and so on, because they didn't even have Alaska gear. We won, naturally, by sheer numbers and everything, but it was a real screw-up. And as I say, they said, oh, we're going to do it in 3 days, and it took 3 weeks.
Yeah.
Because it got down to the fact that it was almost man-to-man fighting there. It was they were all dug in and camouflaged, and you mm-hmm. had to literally dig them out mm-hmm. to lick them, you know.
No wonder the official history wants to leave that out.
The official history leaves it out, believe me.
Yeah.
As I say, we won. We kicked them out, you know.
Were you involved in that operation?
That's on that, too. No, because mm-hmm. I was in this force that went over to Shamia, mm-hmm. and we're building this big, what was going to be the B-29 base.
Yeah.
I was not personally involved in combat. I didn't have anybody shooting at me because I was in this force, which was formed, and all that happened literally when the Battle of Attu was still going on.
I see.
Mm-hmm. And I was very fortunate in that respect. But the numbers involved compared to what was going on in Europe, I mean, was small. And as I say, it was U.S. territory, and and Roosevelt wanted to keep it quiet. Mm-hmm. And of course, since the whole Aleutian Chain is part of Alaska and it was United States, we could control it. I mean, as far as censorship and control the press and the whole thing, everything else, you know.
Fascinating story.
The Canadians worked with us and helped us and furnished ships to take guys up there and so on. But very few people know about it, I can tell you.
Yeah. Well, now
of course, we dropped the bomb, you know, so the war ended. So the B-29s never actually, I think they sent some up later, but the big B-29 thing never really happened. But we had plenty of B-17s, 24s and 25s on Shebya, and they're bombing, they're doing bombing runs over to Kamchatka and northern Japan every day, round the clock. And see, before we had Shemya, that was another thing, before we had Shemya, they're bombing from bases like Adak, which was beyond fighter range, so our bombers could not have fighter escort. After, another big thing with getting Shemya was it was within fighter plane range of the bombing. So our bombers had fighter pilot, fighter plane escorts to help them, to defend them when they got over near Japan and were, you know, Japanese setting up their bomber, their fighters trying to shoot us down and so on. That was another big plus for doing the base at Shemya. It was long range, but the fighters could make it. And literally, there was this whole operation, this provisional truck company, this huge thing, had two officers, one first lieutenant and one second. We were attached. We were hauling all this stuff round the clock.
Yeah, that was hard duty. Well, Felix, what a fascinating story, from playing King Arthur's Knights of the Round Table to being one of the, perhaps the pivotal founder of KVNF in Paonia, Colorado.
All right, I've talked it out. Oh, my God, I've talked it out.
The Flyovers is underwritten in part by the Western Colorado University School of Environment and Sustainability, preparing students to become leaders for positive change in their natural and social communities. You can learn more about the Flyovers and follow future episodes at theflyovers.com.
And that was an interview with KVNF founder Felix Belmont from independent producer Alan Wardes. That concludes the Wildcard Hour, and stay tuned for Cooking with Jazz.